それでは、セッションの後
We will start the afternoon program. We received the comment by Dr. Kira Abala. It was a very insightful comment about the papers. And as I have listened to the discussions, as I mentioned at the outset, what we discussed yesterday was within the international global framework. We looked at the situation of the conflict, and today we are hearing more about the individual countries and individual cases. In all the presentations, the community and the society were discussed specifically. So, education, culture, or the role of the regional elites were referred to. Different aspects were discussed. As I listened to the talks today, there are two aspects that I would like to suggest that we engage in discussion. When we talk about the society and the community, as Dr. Kira Weller mentioned, there is the state versus the community. When the state has failed, when the state governance has collapsed, then you can only depend on the community and the society. So someone else has to play the role of the state, and different actors might be emerging. So who can play the role when the state has collapsed? There could be norm and practices unique to the society. There might be order recovering capacity of the community that we can rely upon. Professor Sugiono mentioned that there must be some traditional right, traditional capacity that managed to heal the wound. Now, when the state has failed, when the state is absent, what can be done? Where is the capacity of the community? Can we make use of that competence and the capacity of the community? And when the state has failed, who can fill in that gap? Professor Obashal also mentioned that, first of all, it should not be an anarchy. We cannot have an anarchy. The state needs to be maintained. But if the state has failed, how can we reconstruct the state? How can we recover the situation? That would be the discussion that I would like to engage in. Another point is also about the society and the community. In particular, if you look at the developing societies, there are community building capacity that is unique to the community. For long years, traditionally, they have managed to maintain social cohesion. They have order, awareness, and norm that have managed to maintain their peaceful coexistence. But as Dr. Caravella mentioned at the end of his speech, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, they might have had traditional norms, but of course, that has not remained unchanged through globalization, through information flowing through industrialization, through modernization. Changes have occurred, and those traditional norms and practices must have been reconstructed, must have been re-established. As I look at the Middle East, I do understand that point, because until some time ago, there was some kind of mechanism that kept this society together, and all of a sudden, because of a little subtle problem, it plunges into a serious conflict. That is what I am seeing in the Middle East. Then at the local level, how can they reconstruct the society? It is important that we learn from history, but at the same time, if we learn something from society, how can we apply it today for sustainability? And is that mechanism the same with the competence of the community that they have managed to maintain their societies long time ago? More specifically, if there are unique identities of the community, what are those identities exactly? there might be such a question that we might pursue. When we talk about identity or use the word identity, as Professor Obachal mentioned, and it was the key point of his discussion, who are the terrorists? Where does the terrorist come from? Is that a fixed origin of a terrorist? In the second half of Professor Obachal's paper, he ran out of time, and it was unfortunate that he could not go into details. But in the second part of his paper, he discussed that only a handful of terrorists emerge from a bigger population. And we must delineate between those terrorists and the non-terrorists. But that classification is not that easy, because violence, coercion are not the only means that the terrorists manage to survive. There are other reasons why terrorists manage to survive. And they do not depend only on the identity as a terrorist within a local community. For example, as a farmer, as a peasant, maybe they are working. 85% they are a farmer, and 15% they might be a terrorist, or a combatant, or a warrior. So there is a complex identity in one individual, and one community has different identities. In this very complex situation, how can we eliminate and reduce violence? This might sound abstract, but that would be another question that I would like to pose as a material for our discussion. Again, I am occupying the microphone, sorry. So, first of all, before we ask the audience to ask questions, because Dr. Kirawala has offered his insightful comments and reactions, I would like to invite the original speakers back again to react to the comment of Dr. Kirawala. We would like to ask the reaction, reflection of the speakers vis-a-vis what Dr. Kirawala has mentioned. Or, of course, you are welcome to make a comment about what your colleagues have spoken, if you have any reaction, any questions to your fellow panelists, that would also be fine. May I suggest you start with 2-3 minutes or maximum 5 minutes? Professor Obachal.
I would like to add some information about the local people's capacity for cooperation after a very divisive conflict in their society, which studies that other people and myself, also with my students, have done in Bosnia. Last time we did this was about two summers ago, so about a year and a half ago. And I would just like to talk about findings and match it with your findings. We found that any institution that was connected with the major ethnic groups, religious divisions, political parties, and education institutions remained quite divisive. As some of these were linked to the state, some of it was linked to international organizations like the religious groups there, Catholics, Muslims, and Orthodox. And in fact, a lot of NGO support for, let's say, religious groups made the divisions even greater because they targeted the Arab states, targeted the Muslim population and NGOs. The Catholic Church and other Catholic groups targeted the Bosniaks who are Croatian origin, and so on. Now, this is not a nice kind of finding, but there were some positive places where the people themselves, as you mentioned, created unity, cooperation. One of them was young people. Young people who were interested in the future learning foreign languages like German and English in community centers, we would find that they actually, these institutions included all the major ethnic groups, and their young people cooperated. Young people cooperated in internet cafes and on computer skills learning and hooking up with a worldwide web. Young people also had a lot of cooperation across these divisions on rock concerts and other entertainments and pop music, international, you know, music that brought them together and, in fact, created international ties, just like the World Wide Web. Sports is another very interesting development because all the major sports, but I'm also including things like track and field, wrestling, kayaking, you know, basketball, of course, soccer, the pre-war leagues, city teams and leagues and associations had reconstituted themselves, and they were actually playing teams from the other other ethnic groups and other parts of Bosnia. They had a lot of help from international and European Federation to do this. They had to overcome a lot of resistance on the part of the political and sort of ministry officials. This was a flourishing sector. Now, another interesting place where these cross-ethnic cooperative relations formed was the workplace. Not so much neighborhoods and between neighbors, but the workplace. That is, when people are put together and to work together, they value teamwork and they start looking upon one another as, what is your contribution to our effort? And they no longer think, you know, you're a Serb, you're a Muslim or something, but they say, what can you do? What can you do? How well do you do it? Now, this, to me, a post-conflict concentrated employment program that is non-discriminatory. If you give the politicians the right to discriminate in the employment markets, you cannot do this. But if the international bureaucracy that was important in Bosnia managed to get a lot of this employment integration realized, and the effects of it are very positive in terms of lasting cooperation. Now, NGO activity, I'm sorry to report to you, had rather negative consequences because sort of local politicians and officials and important people managed to kind of become the associate of a foreign NGO, and then they would use that association to fill the rest of the positions and monies to their own clients and so on. So this is sort of a mixed bag of findings. People are, especially young people, are very resourceful in trying to recreate some cooperation. The people who gained and benefited and made the conflict are doing their utmost to prevent that and to put blocks into its way, and it's and that's sort of the main resistance. If those people were removed, either by the voters or by some other way, then this process would proceed in a faster way. So I wanted to tell you that what our findings are in a totally different part of the world on precisely your problem. Yeah, thank you.
Dr. Gilbert?
Let me make a few comments on the questions raised by the panel chair on weak states or failed states or collapsed states, I think it was mentioned. In the case of Cambodia, Cambodia is not a failed state in the sense that the state has the capability of controlling its own territory and thus reducing or eliminating the possibility of someone challenging it in terms of armed conflict. But it is in many ways a very weak state in other fields, for example, in regulatory and extractive functions. So the result of this is that the state, while it is well equipped with laws and regulations, doesn't really use them to create or to produce greater economic equity, opportunity, and so on. Does not use its capability in terms of extracting funds for public or for public goods. So if you want to build a road in Cambodia, you get foreign aid. If you want to build a school, somebody builds it for you. If somebody gets sick, there is no health system. So it's a sort of a strongman state in one area and a weak state in another area. What then happens in that vacuum? Is the community then capable of providing the services that the state would normally provide? I think here we need to see Cambodia in its historical context, because the Khmer Rouge set out to destroy the existing community and create an entirely different community. You force everyone out of the cities. You kill those who have education or even wearing glasses, which would lead to substantial numbers of casualties in this audience, including myself. You begin the process of creating a completely rural society based on one economic function, that's rice growing. That together with a kind of a populist, Maoist, a traditional ethnocentric nationalistic view of the greatness of the Khmer nation going back to the Angkorian period. And I think that by and large the Khmer Rouge was pretty successful because this was a very traumatic period over 4 years in which people had to change their views of what was important in their lives, survival. And in order to survive, you had to do all kinds of things that were in violation of the code of ethics or behavior patterns of the community before this took place. So that once people survived this, they came through it, they survived physically, but did they survive psychologically, emotionally? What happened to their value system? And I think that there is a sense of collective amnesia. You would like to forget about what happened in this period of time. But there was also some real forgetting of what kind of ethical values or community values existed prior to this time. Then you have the people who were born after the Khmer Rouge period, the young people today. They don't know very much about the Khmer Rouge period, at least not the people we teach at Panasasta University. Part of that is, I think, a fairly normal parental wish to spare your children some of the agony that you have lived through. You don't talk about it. And the Khmer Rouge period is not systematically taught in the public school system. So this is a generation that has no real anchor in previous community values and is floundering, if you will, to establish some new values. And for better or worse, and I think, unfortunately, very often, in a negative sense, they become Americanized or they become globalized. They're looking for things that come from the outside. Our students are certainly excessively enamored of the United States. And try to copy behavior patterns and even speech patterns from the United States. And I think that comes from this vacuum that developed. So we have a lot of things wrapped up together, but I don't think that the community per se is capable of taking over the functions the state is not providing, because the community values that existed are either gone or consciously forgotten. So who does community building in Cambodia? A lot of NGOs that work at the local level and try to equip the local people with the kind of capacity necessary for them to survive, sustainable development, and also try to help people develop a sense of community, not just isolation one from the other, but a community, and try to bring back some of the values that had existed before and had been forgotten. So this is a very complicated business, and it is one I think that it'll take a long time to complete this process or to have even limited success in it.
Thank you.
For 2 minutes or 3 minutes?
From Professor Kirawila, the main point that I got from you, I think, let's see if I'm clear, you talked about the Galtung's triangle of attitude, structure, behavior. But I didn't get exactly what the point is that you were making about that in relationship to my presentation. So if you could perhaps clarify, I could then respond.
Okay. Yes. In our pursuit to peace and peace-building process, attitudinal change is very important. When we think of behavioral psychological perspective, then human nature is very important. Then, in order to promote peace, first of all, we have to strengthen peace in individual mindsets. And at the same time, it is very necessary to have a broader perspective of peace. Yes, it is true. It is very necessary. At the same time, it is very difficult to isolate this one with related structures. Because of the triangular, the dialectical relationship between behavior, structure, and attitudes should be taken into account. Because if you don't address the structures that promote violence and the conflict, you will not be able to promote individual level peace and mindset.
I got you, yes. Well, first of all, I personally am very critical of this theory of behavior, attitude, structure. It comes from a certain psychology that's implicit in it. It comes from the 19th century attempt to create a positivist psychology. I think human beings, we are much more than values, attitudes, and behavior. That's the main psychology of personality. We're finding now a renewal in psychology, and it has implications for other disciplines, like pedagogy, therefore peace studies as well. It's coming back to concepts of character rather than personality. Character you can find in many cultural traditions. In the East, you find it in the Confucian tradition. Character and virtues are the main constituents of the human person. Virtues and character strengths. You find this in Aristotle as well. So in this view, the human being, we are constituted morally. So one of the big problems about these other kinds of approaches is that usually when we talk about values and attitudes, we separate the values. We're not concerned about how people internalize values into their life and incarnate their values, which is basically the concept of virtues and the virtuous life. So I think also we have to look at which context we're talking about. I wasn't this morning referring so much to the context of societies that are embroiled in ongoing violent conflict or chronic conflict. My context was really global. I question very deeply also the assumption that there are developing and developed countries. I don't think that so-called developed countries are really that developed from the point of view of human development in terms of our potentials, as moral agents or societies that really promote human flourishing. I think the global dialogue has to be much deeper in that sense. Now, I will admit that one thing I did not say this morning about this theory that we do have these two sides of our human nature, which you will find in all cultures, the side that has to deal with adversity, with violence, we might act violently and so on, and the other side that deals with sociability, joyfulness, and human development and flourishing. In situations of stress, as chronic conflicts are characteristic, this adversity, emotional, motivational action system becomes dominant. That's why it's so easy. Yes, you can get caught up in situations where there is social paranoia. So you might reach some kind of a peacekeeping situation, but then going into the peace building phase becomes very difficult. Yes, this can happen. But I think that, to me, the questions that I'm more interested in right now are of a more global nature, because I think as a humanity we are facing together great challenges and great opportunities in our time.
ありがとうございました。じゃあ杉尾の先生。
Thank you, Professor Sugiono.
Yes. Thank you very much. One question put forward by Professor Gravila was that is it possible to bring the previous tradition into the scene, given the fact that our time is now the time of globalization, where information technology is dominating our daily life. Yes, of course, we cannot rely on the traditional, which is quite different from our time. But the point is that what I would like to put forward was that we have, however, keep on looking into the potential of local people and the capacity of their people, of these people, to bring peace among themselves. And this has been proven quite successful in their interaction with each other. So this is the point that I would like to say. And this, at the same time, should be a warning to those working with a conflict situation from outside, either from government, from NGOs, and from academics. They should not simply bring about theoretical framework and not only bringing about the universal understanding of conflict without knowing exactly what happened in the society. So one of our publications based on the research on this local capacity for peace building was published in 2005 with the title Nonviolent Resistance. One of the important messages that we would like to bring in this publication was that, okay, in the conflict situation, we tend to separate between one and another conflicting parties, and looking at their experience, those people's experience in the conflict areas, basically they don't have such framework. Enemy and friends. Enemy and friend is the framework that used to be brought about by the observer from outside to characterize this group has a conflict with that group. But inside the society, it is rarely really found. And people in this conflict help each other without saying, without thinking, oh, you are Christian, I don't want to help you. Or you are Muslim, I don't want to help you. No, they don't have such framework. The framework of enemy is not the framework that they have. So I'm afraid that unless we understand the situation very, very clearly, our presence in the conflicting area will exaggerate the problem rather than help the people to bring conflict. And I think I thank Professor Obershall to help me also with his finding in his own research that I think in one way or another also fit my finding. Thank you very much.
ありがとうございました。あと残り30分。
Thank you very much. We have roughly 30 minutes to take questions from the floor. If there are any questions, please raise your hand and kindly wait for the microphone. As we did yesterday, we will just collect 5 or 6 questions. There will be two rounds or so please try to be concise with your questions. Dr. Cook, Professor Mushakoji, and this gentleman, and behind that, the person, and at the back, that person. First five questions.
One for each panelist, and the first one would go to Dr. Obershall. And I'm wondering, and I think we spoke about this earlier, the model that he's presented allows temporary space for states to suspend, presumably, some framework of their morality with respect to how they approach terrorism questions. I wonder how, in that light, we protect democracy. Because it seems to me that the moment that we do that, we begin to degrade the whole process, and the United States has certainly had experience with that. These are structural issues in which at the very center of democracy is justice, and of course we have machinery of government degraded on a permanent basis. I'd be interested in how he responds to that. For Professor Gilberg, I wanted to talk just very briefly about the idea of failed state. I'm very concerned about the extent to which we've now really created a categorical imperative on failed states, and that's now become part of the machinery of all of the major multilateral and bilateral institutions. I want to make the distinction between states that have failed the international system, about which I think the institutions are primarily concerned, and states that have failed their own citizens. And I think that that distinction is extremely important because a lot of the work that we're doing really focuses on states that have failed the international system. For Professor Brennus, I wanted to basically put the question of what would institutions look like that were built on the assumption that a psychology of human morality and human character were the fundamental drivers. Would we not begin to enter a fundamentalism that was dangerous? That's a question. And finally, I'd like to maybe suggest to Professor Seguino that I think that it's absolutely wonderful that he's beginning to really look at these problems from bottom up and looking at what happens in local community. But as the state moves into the territory of these people, is it not a redefinition, which you suggested at the end, that is in some important way irreversible? Have we not already destroyed the strategic sites and the mechanisms for local decision-making capability? Sorry, that's a lot of questions.
Thank you. I have a question two questions to Professor Obershall. Again, about the suspension of the Geneva Convention, other international law principles. It is, my question is based on, is about whether you agree that if you have to suspend, you should still have two basic principles in mind. One is the legitimacy itself of the democratic states. The second is how not to alienate the non-terrorists, the doves, by penalizing the hawks. My first question, very briefly, I am saddened as a friend of Europe about the two networks which are now established for the protection of the security of the citizens of the European community. One is the hidden network for the interrogation of the potential terrorists, which is, I believe, it exists. The second one, which is officially recognized, is the large network which covers also the Maghreb and and Turkey and so on, of the also camps, which is to arrest the illegal migrants and to return them back. And these two set of networks are indispensable for the security of Europe, probably, but they are just giving a very negative image about what democracy is in Europe. So this is my first question. My second is about alienation of the doves. I see the need to arrest even potential terrorists from the Islamic countries, but by doing so, is it not also a problem if this is not creating necessarily new terrorists, but at least you have sympathizers of the terrorists, not about their method, but about their cause, which is broadening in the Arab world and the Muslim world, especially also in Europe and North America. And this is creating more threats for the having terrorists. This is more probably a question also to Professor Chiravella. It's about the fact that at some point there was possibility of negotiation between the Sri Lankan government and the LTTE, and it was interrupted because, and it was also, there was a Japanese responsibility to that, but they held a meeting between the LTTE and the government, and also the supporters for economic cooperation in Washington. And of course, there the American government had to tell that LTTE was a terrorist organization. But at that time, the terrorist organization had ceased, at least temporarily, to be using terrorist methods. So if they continued not to talk about terrorism, probably they would have just stopped using terrorism. But since they were called terrorists and on all channels of negotiation was eliminated in that way, the LTTE went back to terrorism because it was called terrorist. That is one interpretation I have. And this is where it is alienating the doves among the LTTE who seek some political solution and not a military solution. So my question is whether the suspension of all these justice and human rights principles have not, don't you think it has to be limited in terms of not creating more supporters of terrorists, because this is not very sustainable? Thank you.
For short, 1 or 2 minutes.
Question number one, is it appropriate for us as peace educators to be using labels as terrorists or insurgents? If we're being called to be the examples of peace, are we not being hypocritical in supporting the very things that we say we want to stop by using these terms? Questions, that was question one and two. Question three, the conventions that have been created, such as the Geneva Convention and all the global declarations, although very honorable, begin to fade into a gray area or an area of questionability when new evidence is coming out to support that wars are being doctored or being created in order to be simply sustained for profiteering. So how can we trust the powers to that create these conventions when everything that they are doing appears to be in blatant disregard for the very things that they claim to be advocating? And question four, in these situations, is warfare ever conventional? when the majority of the people are being called to serve and protect the power interests of the minority.
Thank you. 次の方、じゃあ、こちらも、1、2分でお願いいたします。それから、
So the next question, please be brief. And I mentioned we would like to access 5 questions, but I may not have time to ask others to questions. So who else had questions? And so, Desmond, I'm sorry. And one more. So we will receive additional 3 questions, but please be very brief.
Thank you for your presentation. My question is, in your ongoing study, are you integrating the aspect of natural resource management? By this, I mean if your traditional value, which is contributing to reduce conflict, that kind of traditional value, is it based on some in some way or others to specific way of natural resource management, particularly in the case of Kalimantan, like forest management, etc. So this is my question. Thank you.
じゃあその後ろの女性の方。
Thank you. The next person in the back.
For the older presentation, I was really impressed. I have one question based on like there's a lot of discussion about local level.What's kind of what the local level can contribute to the peace. But still the international actor, a strong actor in the case of peace building, because the, like in the case of Cambodia, they are putting a lot of money for the national budget. And also in the case of Afghanistan, the international fund, like supporting for the refugees, also that like leading for the, like,influences the conflict itself. So I want to know that, like, how the international actor or also the new aspect of the diaspora is influencing the local level activities, or how the these kind, like, there's not much relation, not discussion about like international level of the or the those who are outside of the countryare influencing in the inside of the people. So I would like to know if there is some comment. Thank you.
じゃあこちら。Desmond, wait. We'll go from here. Then your third.
Actually, my name is Intisar. I'm a student in Peace and Conflict Studies. I have 2 questions. Actually, the first is directed to the Professor Prince, and I hope kindly from him to reply it. The first question is that is the motivation or attitudes really affect the conflict and identify its type? I mean, motivations can really affect the conflicts, its dimensions, the degree of conflict itself. So in case that the motivation has decreased, so do you think that the degree of conflict will be increased? And who really could control the motivation? So it is mainly dependent on the internal forces, I mean, the internal forces to control the motivations, or it depends on external forces to be involved in the process of controlling motivations. This is the first question. The second question is directed to Professor Sigino. Actually, Iraq is included as a state with differing ethnic diversity. So I want to ask that before 2003, before the war, there was no conflict. I mean, there is no conflict. So, and more precisely, before 2006. But after the 2006 and the bombing of Holy Shrine, Samarra, the degree of conflicts has increased. So there was an escalating conflict. So do you think that the educating people can be regarded as a process to control the degree of conflict? and it can be regarded as conflict resolutions. And do you think that it will be enough to deal with conflict?
I'm Tsuyoshi Ohira from the University of Kitakyushu. I have a question to Professor Sugiono. Professor Sugiono mentioned three approaches to see the causes of conflicts and pointed out the lack of the perspective from the local people. But I would like to add another approach, fourth approach, which emphasizes the international influences. It may be included in the third approach, structuralist approach, but Professor Sugiono emphasized the internal factors only. So, for example, in the former Yugoslav society, there was a culture in which people could live well. But after the collapse of the Soviet Union, like other Eastern countries, the socialist regime ended in the former Yugoslavia. At the last point in the presentation, Professor Sugiono mentioned the culture before the conflict in which people could live well with the neighbors. I suppose in the case of the former Yugoslavia, that culture was a product of the socialist regime. Because of the change of the global settings, people lost the chance to live well. If my assumption is correct, is it possible to retrieve traditional values based on the vast framework like a regime? Thank you.
Yeah, two short comments. One directed towards Professor Obershall. I'm a practitioner. For 20 years, that practitioner was as a military officer in a counterinsurgency environment. Now, I know well the methodology of the British Army in Northern Ireland, and it seems to me that the methodology, which is a slight deviation from international humanitarian law, or in that context, international human rights law, includes the murder of unarmed civilians, the collusion with terrorist organizations towards murder, and the collusion with terrorist organizations in the placement of bombs in the Republic of Ireland. So I find that a bit shocking that you would feel that such a deviation from international law, which is a dive into the abyss, could be condoned. The second point is that as a practitioner, and 10 years after in the international community, including with the UN and disarmament, I note that we are here searching for a new approach to peace building and conflict prevention on the wall there. Well, let me tell you, there is a major communications gap between the practitioner and the academic. The academic is writing beautiful papers which are appearing in beautiful exclusive journals which practitioners are not reading because they don't have time. They don't have time to read them. They probably can't understand the language that you speak in. And secondly, they can't afford the subscriptions like some of our universities. So, you know, there is a further communications gap in that from my own specialization, as I have snuck into academia here to find out what's going on, academia is 4 years, 5 years behind the curve of what we are doing in the field. There is a gap both directions. And if we're looking for a new way for peace building and conflict resolution, I think that we could probably take some of that Western academia and do the regression analysis that Mushikoji Sensei is so suspicious of and find out just how much academia is impacting on the reduction of violence. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the questions. We only have 5 minutes left according to the schedule, so I would like to ask for the reaction by the speakers. I know 1 minute is impossible, so may I suggest 2 minutes each? By 2 minutes each, could I ask the speakers to respond? 2 minutes.
Sorry, I just can't be done. I mean, it would be totally massacring and being superficial. I just can't do it in 2 minutes.
But in the afternoon, we will have more time for discussion. So we can go back to the discussion at the very final portion of discussion. So at this moment, if brief responses can be made, if you can please do so at this moment from this side.
Regarding the Sri Lankan situation, negotiations, in Sri Lanka, we have two interrelated problems. One is ethnic problem, other one is separatist war. You know, we have to be very clear about ethnic problem. Ethnic problem is not a conflict between two communities, ethnic communities. That is not ethnic the conflict. Ethnic conflict is different from apartheid. Ethnic conflict is basically conflict over the ownership of the state. It is not the between ethnic two ethnic communities. Because of the state failed to develop an ideology of a state in order to accommodate all the interests of ethnic groups in the state, certain ethnic groups alienate from the state. That is the exactly ethnic problem. Because of the ethnic problem, we have separatist war. Therefore, in this situation, for ethnic conflict, we have negotiated settlement. Yes, without negotiated settlement, we will not be able to solve the ethnic problem. Then tricky issues, how to deal with separatist war. Even separatist war, it is very necessary to have developed some political solution to the ethnic problem where LTTE can lay down arms within united Sri Lanka. Therefore, the way of the forward would be negotiated settlement with condition LTTE should lay down arms within within mutually agreed political framework. Regarding the Washington conference, LTTE was denied because ultimately behind the table, state government wanted formal declaration on the part of LTTE to denounce use of force. LTTE declined that thing. That's why the LTTE was not invited to the Washington conference. Then after the Tokyo contact, Mr. Akashi went to Mulativ jungles and waiting hours and met Mr. Prabhakaran and tried to persuade Mr. Prabhakaran to send the envoys to Tokyo conference. Mr. Prabhakaran said no. Therefore, Japanese government and Japanese initiative failed to influence LTTE to come to the negotiating the Tokyo Contab. Very short.
Okay, let me address myself very briefly to the question of failed state. Okay, it's true that this is used in primarily in IR, and I agree that we ought to take a look at states that fail its own citizens. Now, of course, any regime that survives is not failing everybody. It's not failing itself. Otherwise, it wouldn't survive. But there are states that fail substantial parts of their citizens in providing basic goods and services that would make it possible for these people to sustain themselves. And this is one of the things that is very valuable when we think about the kind of research project we are talking about here. Who is being failed? Clearly, when 35% of the Cambodian population lives on a dollar a day or less, there's a problem here. Certainly, when children die by the thousands because of lack of very basic medication for malaria, somebody is failing somebody. And so if we are looking at thresholds of potential conflict, when will the people who are being failed engage in action to fix this problem? Or are they so downtrodden that they cannot act? This is one of the things that we will discuss or try to analyze in the project I was talking about here. In that regard, we can say Cambodia is at least in substantial measure failing substantial numbers of its own citizens. The question is whether those who are being failed will have an opportunity to progress beyond that particular state of desperation. Now, international actors in Cambodia. Yes, there is a lot of money going into Cambodia. And where does it go? Well, some of it ends up at the grassroots, but not a great deal. Quite a bit of it ends up in the fees for consultants. Much of what is being bought with this money is designated in the sense you have to buy from the donor country. And needless to say, since I mentioned corruption already, much of it ends up in private pockets, not in the public treasury. So there's an enormous amount of wastage here. And in Cambodia, every year at the donors' meeting, that's when all the major donors are pumping in $500-600 million a year, when they meet with the government, this is a perennial sore point. But the experience I've had since I was in Cambodia was the donor community complains, the government promises change, but no substantial change takes place. And one of the most blatant examples of this, I think, was some years ago, a couple of years ago. The head of the World Bank was in Cambodia. There was widespread agreement. There was a lot of corruption going on. And the head of the World Bank says, here's $10 million to study corruption. A lot of Cambodians were saying they don't need to study corruption. They know about this already. So we should use the money in some other way. Now, add to Desmond. Well, Desmond, if there's a communications gap, it certainly is not because you haven't been speaking out very loudly here today. And I will invite you when you come to Cambodia to come and enlighten us at Panyasastra about this gap. But I do have a question to you. If you guys are 5 years ahead of academics, where are the great results of what you're doing?
Well, after that exchange of sparring, intellectual sparring, I can address the question about motivations and conflicts, I think, meaningfully. I think a distinction has to be made. What happens when human beings are engrossed in a conflict that's life-threatening, or threatening of valued goods? Of course, security-oriented motivations will be dominating, seeking security. To me, that's not the interesting question. To me, the question is, why in the world is the whole world right now caught up in the security paradigm? And are the so-called peaceful, stable societies really that peaceful? Really that? What I've really missed in this conference so far is a more systemic approach to the world system and what's going on. And I don't think we can really understand the violence and conflict situations in the poorer countries, which seems to be where the focus of attention has been, without looking what's going on in the rich countries that have been draining the resources from these other countries for centuries. You know, it's a systemic relationship, and we're talking about competitive societies and this logic of competition, which easily. That motivation moves over into violent competition in certain threshold situations. So there's a disjuncture here in our analyses that I think we really should be overcoming. I mean, who are we to have the luxury, as the gentleman who condemns the academics, sometimes rightfully so, who are we to be analyzing and deciding what's effective in countries where people, you know, are suffering, they're dying, they're starving. I mean, what are our motivations coming from? So that I return the question to all of us in that sense. I do believe in the moral capacity of human beings, Professor Cook. I don't know exactly where your fear or distrust of the concept of virtue and fundamentalism is exactly coming from. So I don't know. I can't address that. Yes. Well, my vision, I think that in the past it's true that there have been collectivist-oriented societies where an ethic of duties is imposed on the individual. And there are many kinds of fundamentalisms of this nature. What I'm talking about is a very different kind of thing. It's the question if it's possible to create a foundation for an ethics of duty based on an ethics of virtue, where the good that is being sought after, say it's my happiness, takes on its meaning when we can be collectively happy and I am freely contributing to seek that common good. So it's all the question to me is, in a world where we've been promoting a sort of possessive individualistic human being, nobody likes to be, you know, told what their duties and obligations are. We defend freedom, you know, so strongly. But are we really free in a neoliberal society, which tells us that we have to, you know, live compulsively to consume? Is that freedom? I would say that's not freedom. I think there's also the important dialectic between outer freedom and the inner freedom to be able to envisage positive states of peaceful living, and where the personal happiness only is possible if there's a collective happiness, but we freely engage. So in this kind of view, the developing of human virtues is part and parcel of the development of the beingness, of the goodness of the society as a whole.
Excuse me. Could you continue the discussion? Okay. Sugiono.
Thank you very much.
Professor Sugiono?
About the possibility of bringing a local mechanism or a traditional ritual into the conflict resolution. Is it still possible in the far-reaching hand of the state? Yes, this is, of course, quite problematic. But there are also cases where a tradition survive from this far-reaching influence of the state. We can see quite clearly recently with the case of Bali bombings. Yes, what happened to the people in Bali? Okay, and compare it to the way in which the United States react to the attack of the WTO. As the Bali bombed twice even, the people suffer very much. No tourists came to Bali. All the countries warned the citizen not to go to Bali. And of course, most of the people in Bali rely on tourism as the source of life. But still, they didn't react to the bombings by attacking Muslims living in the society in Bali. What they did instead, they performed so many rituals, reflecting themselves, what have we done? What kind of sin we have done? So in these rituals, basically were about cleaning themselves from the past mistake that they have done, from the sins that they have done, and so on and so on. Rather than blaming others, they try to blame themselves and try to be submissive to the nature, to God, and so on and so on. And this is the way in which the traditional people solve the conflict and still survive until now, even under the heavy influence of the central government during the Suharto's government. And this works until now. So the life in Bali is still very harmonious between Balinese and even with Muslim. And the Muslim live very, very well there until now without having fear of being interrogated or being attacked by Balinese. So I believe that there are still wisdom in that, and we can make use of this wisdom, and we should try to understand that and make use of that as the main framework to build conflict, to build peace in the society. And this is also exactly related to the point of the use of traditional way of like in the resources management. And it is also again the case of Balinese who has a very, very positive attitude toward nature. And to cut a tree, then they have to perform some kind of ritual and so on and so on, which at the end, it is not the ritual that matters, but the fact that they are not very easily cut a tree just because they treat the tree as a living creature as well. And different from the way in which the government did with the forest in Kalimantan, for example, when the commercialization, the government sees the trees as commercial, has a commercial aspect rather than sacred aspect, then the life of the trees and forests are in danger, but not in the Bali. Thank you very much.
ありがとうございました。まだまだ質問がたくさんあるかと思います。
Thank you so much. I know there are many questions that you want to ask, but time does not permit us, so we just have to conclude this session. As I mentioned, we shall have more time for discussion. There was a strong criticism about the gap between the academia and the practitioners. There were serious criticism as well, and we welcome such intervention because that is what we have to talk about. In Japanese sayings, we say that if you understand the ghosts, they were nothing but a standing tree. But in a sense, academia might be considered as a ghost, but if you believe that we are something else, that would at least be meaningful. Thank you.